Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, March 30th, 2025. This program was previously broadcast on September 8th, 2024. We open with a guest essay from the New York Times, dated September 2nd, 2024, and written by Margaret Rinkle, who is a contributing opinion writer who covers flora, fauna, politics, and culture in the American South. The essay is entitled, "In a Brutal Summer, Miracles Still Bloom." Drought is a kind of madness. Drought combined with record heat makes you long to become subterranean, a mole digging into cool darkness. This longing feels the way desire feels when you are too young to recognize it as desire. Even safely inside a cool house, your body is telling you that something is off. What you long for cannot be had. Until you think about it for a moment, it can't even be named. As a matter of technical fact, Davidson County, Tennessee, where I live, is not in a state of drought, but the scattered showers that have blown in briefly here and there throughout the summer have not come to our yard. We got one hot rain so gentle it hardly broke the leaf canopy, and that was it for us all summer long. The forecasters at Nashville Severe Weather call these random pop-up showers, playing the watery, like a lottery but with water. Day after day last week, the temperature climbed, 99, 100, 101, 102, and the air quality alerts arrived in flocks. Nashville Electric Service sent me an email. Tips for extreme heat in Music City this week. In the photos on the pet rescue sites that I check obsessively now, hoping to find just the right canine family member for this newly dogless house, all the dogs are panting. I feel the need to pant myself. I hang the wet sheets on the clothesline and watch winged insects glittering down for a drink. Everyone is thirsty, but it's the insects I worry about most, the tiny ones too fragile to chance drinking from the water dishes we set out for everyone else. Despite the heat, I take a daily census of my pollinator garden. Early September is peak insect season in Middle Tennessee, but I'm worried about my winged neighbors. Some butterflies and native bees are especially stressed by heat, and drought is hard on everybody. We can't afford to lose any of our pollinators. In just the past 40 years, we've already lost nearly half the world's insects. Every day I am thankful to find my pollinator garden buzzing. The showiest summer perennials, bee balm and milkweed and coneflower, and black-eyed Susan and Joe Pye weed and swamp rose mallow, are all bloomed out now. But the ironweed and mistflower and goldenrod and frostweed and blue lobelia and mountain mint and boneset are covered with winged and crawling things. Not all these creatures are feeding on flowers. By the time I take my lunchtime stroll around the yard, the carpenter bees have taken over the zinnias and the black-eyed Susans. Their preferred flowers, the blooms of the passion vine, don't open till later in the afternoon. Even the zinnias, whose outer petals are missing, torn away by goldfinches harvesting seeds, are still pumping out pollen. The bees aren't troubled by the missing petals. I take immense pleasure from watching the carpenter bees work the passion flowers. Only a carpenter bee is large enough to pollinate a passion flower, and this year's extravagant bounty of passion fruit attests to the bees' work. A passion fruit isn't ripe until it falls to the ground. Ripe passion fruit feeds birds and squirrels and opossums and foxes and raccoons and me. Passion vine is the sole host plant of the Gulf fritillary butterfly, and every day now the female butterflies flit above the vines, depositing eggs on the newest growth and the freshest tendrils. Soon the caterpillars will hatch and begin their own work of clearing the vines of leaves. Just as the ripe passion fruit begins to fall, the caterpillars will be emerging from their chrysalides, butterflies. I have come to rely on this deeply interdependent cycle, vine, leaf, flower, bee. butterfly, caterpillar, fruit, hungry wildlife. I cling to it as tightly as any goldfinch hanging upside down from a nodding sunflower. However tragically the climate crisis has disrupted other natural patterns, this one seems as sturdy as the drought-impervious passion vine itself, its roots anchored so deep in the soil, I couldn't pull them up if I tried. Not every caterpillar survives to become a butterfly. That, too, is part of the cycle. Songbirds feed their young a diet made up overwhelmingly of caterpillars, which are soft, fat with nutrients, and no trouble to catch. If you want to feed the birds, you need to cultivate the plants that feed the caterpillars. In his 2019 book, Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard, the entomologist Douglas W. Ptolemy notes that even the tiniest songbirds, like chickadees, require 6,000 to 9,000 caterpillars to raise a single brood of baby birds. In one way of looking at it, butterflies lay so many eggs because nestlings need so many caterpillars. This is the time of year when weedy gardens like mine make their most persuasive argument for planting natives. A garden full of native wildflowers is a beacon for pollinators. The flowers attract the insects. The insects attract everybody else. The butterflies come singly or in pairs now. Monarchs, eastern tiger swallowtails, black swallowtails, and pipevine swallowtails, plus a few varieties I've never seen here before. One day last week, I was looking out the window when I saw a butterfly moving so fast, I thought at first it was a hummingbird, though it was bigger than a hummingbird and moving quite unlike a hummingbird. I went outside to see what radiant mystery was making use of my zinnias. It turned out to be an eastern giant swallowtail, the largest butterfly in North America. A creature I'd never seen before in my life, and here it was in our yard. The next day I found two huge fifth instar monarch caterpillars on the swamp milkweed. I'd been looking and looking for monarch cats because the milkweed was clearly being chewed up by caterpillars, but nary a caterpillar could I find. I figured the birds and wasps were eating them before I could find them, in the amount of time I was willing to spend out in the full sun of a 100-degree day. Yet here were two who had evaded predators long enough to be hours away from pupating. These are the miracles, once ordinary but now growing rarer, that keep me going. We are a species that ruins too much of what we touch, but we are also the flower-planting species, and we come into this world primed for wonder. One day, many years ago, I walked into the garden with my baby on my hip. "Oh," he breathed. "Oh." I turned to see what was captivating him. It was a patch of flowers covered with swallowtails, gently pulsing their wings. The author, Margaret Renkel, is also the author of the books The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year, Graceland at Last, and Late Migrations. This guest essay, In a Brutal Summer, Miracles Still Bloom, appeared in the New York Times on September 2, 2024. Next, several articles from Science News, the June 29, 2024 issue. First, in the department Earth. When did Earth's water cycle arise? Fresh water may have appeared on the planet 4 billion years ago. By Carolyn Gramling. Earth may have had fresh, not just salty, water less than 600 million years after the planet formed, a mere blink of an eye in geologic time. Researchers analyzed oxygen molecules within 4 billion-year-old zircon crystals from Western Australia's Jack Hills, one of the oldest rock formations on Earth. The relative proportions of oxygen's heaviest and lightest forms, or isotopes, in the zircons are possible only if there had been a significant amount of fresh water present. Geochemist Hamed Gamaleldian of Khalifa University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, and his colleagues report in the June 3rd issue of Nature Geoscience. The finding suggests that freshwater may have been actively cycling on Earth hundreds of millions of years earlier than previously thought. Past studies have found evidence that a robust water cycle, one that involved rain and evaporation from the land back to the atmosphere, and then rain again, existed by at least 3.2 billion years ago. The presence of fresh water has implications for Earth's habitability 4 billion years ago. It doesn't necessarily mean life was present, Gamaleldian says, but at least we have the main ingredient to form life. Currently, the oldest agreed-upon evidence for life on Earth comes from fossilized microbial mats in Australia's Strelley Pool Chert that date to 3.4 billion years ago. Cycles of evaporation and rain alter the chemical makeup of water molecules. When water evaporates from the ocean's surface, leaving the salt behind, the lighter form of oxygen, oxygen 16, tends to evaporate faster than the heavier oxygen 18. That lighter water may then rain out over land and perhaps evaporate again. Over time, the fresh water becomes more concentrated in oxygen 16 compared with the original seawater. When that rainwater percolates through the ground, it can chemically react with bedrock or with magma pockets in the rock, imparting lighter isotopic oxygen values, clues that fresh water was present. The team analyzed oxygen isotopic ratios of over 1,300 zircon crystals, ranging in age from 4.2 billion to 3.3 billion years ago. Most of the zircons had relatively heavy oxygen isotopic values, as would be expected from seawater. At around 3.4 billion years ago and 4 billion years ago, the ratios indicated a greater proportion of lighter oxygen. In the 3.4 billion-year-old zircons, the team measured ratios of oxygen 18 to oxygen 16 that were as low as 0.1 per mil. A measurement of the ratio of those isotopes when compared with the standard oxygen isotopic ratio from ocean water. That value is very low compared with the average for rocks at that time, about 5 per mil. The 4 billion-year-old zircons had oxygen isotopic values that were about 2 per mil. The team ran thousands of computer simulations to determine the likelihood of different explanations for the observed ratios. We concluded that the main water on Earth was oceanic, Gamaleldian says. But only when we used fresh water did it create the results we see. Gamaleldian's team presents a compelling and convincing case that there was fresh water cycling on Earth 3.4 billion years ago. But the jury is still out on whether that was the case 4 billion years ago, says geochemist Jesse Reimink of Penn State. The early Earth is really difficult to study because there are so few data points. Ancient crystals like these remain the only clues that scientists have to Earth's earliest time, he adds. We need to keep pushing the limits of these zircon grains. When did Earth's water cycle arise? Appears in the department Earth. Continuing in the same department, we turn to Kilauea erupted like a stomp rocket toy. Mechanism explains the Hawaiian volcano's odd 2018 outburst. Kilauea is an active shield volcano located on Big Island in the Hawaiian Islands. It is in a closed area of Volcano National Park. This article is also by Carolyn Gramling. A series of explosions from the Hawaiian volcano Kilauea in 2018 may have been triggered by a never-before-seen style of eruption, one that's reminiscent of a stomp rocket. In May of that year, plumes of hot gas and rock shot up to 8 kilometers into the sky as the volcano erupted explosively 12 times in succession. The cause of those unusual blasts was the progressive collapse of Kilauea's summit crater, or caldera, researchers reported on May 27th in the journal Nature Geoscience. Each time large chunks of crater rock plunged into the magma chamber beneath, the sudden compression of air in the chamber sent volcanic debris shooting skyward, much like the way stepping hard on the air bladder of a stomp rocket sends its foam projectile flying, the team says. Explosive volcanic eruptions are usually triggered by some combination of two well-known mechanisms, says geophysicist Joshua Crozier of Stanford University. Depressurization of hot magma as it ascends releases bubbles of gas that can expand to burst molten rock out of the caldera. Alternatively, a rising magma plume can flash heat groundwater in rocks, sending bursts of steam and rock skyward. But neither of the mechanisms could explain Kilauea's strange sequence of explosive eruptions, geophysical data indicated. The erupted material didn't contain bubbly bits of magma, and the rocks were already far too hot to contain much liquid water that could be superheated, Crozier says. He and others suspected that a series of collapses of the volcano's caldera, which began in mid-May, might have had something to do with it. Crozier's team analyzed frequency data on infrasound waves that traveled through the ground during the eruption. A pattern emerged. The chamber seemed to enlarge, and then there was an explosion of some sort. The corresponding seismic data showed a series of distinct earthquakes, each less than magnitude 5. The team suspects that the magma chamber drained enough to make the caldera roof over it unstable, causing that rock to drop downward under its own weight. That decreased the reservoir's volume. Plumes emerged from the summit about 20 to 30 seconds later, the result of air pressurization from the collapsing roof, shooting the hot gas and rock debris in the chamber upward. This is the first time, to my knowledge, that such a mechanism has been suggested to drive eruptions, says volcanologist Larry Mastin of the U.S. Geological Survey's Cascades Volcano Observatory in Vancouver, Washington. It's a rather unusual mechanism, but the circumstances of this eruption are unusual. Stomp rocket-style eruptions probably aren't unique to Kilauea, Crozier says, but the volcano's extensive monitoring system made it possible to detect. The findings, he says, could help researchers reduce hazards from less well-monitored volcanoes. And by the way, the most recent eruption from Kilauea was a brief one on June 3, 2024. And now we turn to the Department of Animals. Baby orangutans try building nests. The precocious apes start honing their techniques in infancy. By Elizabeth Ann Brown. At 6 months old, human infants are still working on sitting up by themselves, but baby orangutans at that age are already developing their engineering skills. Orangutans build complex sleeping platforms as high as 20 meters in the tree canopy, equivalent to about 5 stories above the ground, every single evening. The intricate nests can include woven elements, pillows, blankets, padding, and roofs to protect from rain. But nest building isn't instinctive to orangutans. It has to be learned through years of sometimes hilarious trial and error that starts in infancy, researchers report in the May issue of Animal Behavior. The finding could be important for conserving populations of the critically endangered apes. Treetops are a dangerous place to live when you're so big and heavy, says primatologist Andrea Permana of the University of Warwick in England. A poorly made nest can spell disaster. To see how orangutans become expert canopy architects, Permana and colleagues tracked the development of 27 young Sumatran orangutans at the Sauk Balimbing Monitoring Station in Sumatra, Indonesia, over 13 years. Those observations allowed the researchers to create a detailed timeline of how nest building emerges. By 6 months old, baby orangutans take an active interest in nest building, even adding leaves and twigs to their mother's nest. Young orangutans begin by building day nests, temporary platforms, often in fruit trees, for lounging while foraging. Sometime before their first birthday, they've already started to try and bend branches around in a circle to try and make a nest foundation, Permana says. At this age, they're not always strong enough to get the job done. They'll hang on a branch with their body weight to try and break it, really pulling, trying to bend it, Permana says. They think they've made a circle, and they let go, and it just pings open. You can see they're kind of surprised, like, oh, it's not as easy as it looks. Age 3 to 4 are a frenzy of nest-building practice, as the young orangutans perfect their day nests and try their hand at night nests. Permana recalls one young male named Freddy, who, at about age 3, built and destroyed 21 nests in a single day. They varied wildly in effort, quality, and longevity. By about age 5, young orangutans can build a respectable place to spend the night, usually constructing a nest a few meters above their mother's in the same tree. But even if they go to sleep solo, young orangutans always seem to wake up back in mom's nest until they're fully weaned at about 7 or 8 years old. After they've got the nest building basics down, the comfort features, the roofs and blankets, appear to take still more years of practice to master. The cozy accoutrements show up more frequently in nests made by adults. This study is the first real detailed investigation of the development of nest building in apes, says primatologist Elizabeth Lonsdorf of Emory University in Atlanta. It also underscores the important work done by forest schools, rehabilitation facilities designed to prepare orphaned orangutans for a life in the wild by teaching them key skills, like nest building. Forest schools may need to add something a little extra in the curriculum. There's an element of culture to the bedtime routine, Permana says. Each night, orangutans in suak that include a pillow in their nest make a special vocalization. But it's not the soulful lullaby you might expect from these gentle giants, she says. It's like a human blowing a raspberry. This article, Baby Orangutans Try Building Nests, appears in the Department of Animals. Our next science news article from the June 29th, 2024 issue is part of an ongoing series called The Climate Fix, a series of stories on climate change solutions and how people around the world are tackling the biggest challenge of our time. This article in The Climate Fix looks at crushing climate change. Enhanced rock weathering could capture carbon dioxide and improve cropland, by Anne Leslie Davis. On a banana plantation in rural Australia, a second-generation farming family spreads crushed volcanic rock between rows of ripening fruit. 8,000 kilometers away, two young men in central India dust the same type of rock powder onto their dry season rice paddy, while across the ocean, a farmer in Kenya sprinkles the powder by hand onto his potato plants. Far to the north in foggy Scotland, a plot of potatoes gets the same treatment, as do cattle pastures on sunny slopes in southern Brazil. And from Michigan to Mississippi, farmers are scattering volcanic rock dust on their wheat, soy, and corn fields, with ag spreaders typically reserved for dispersing crushed limestone to adjust soil acidity. Across six continents, these farmers are experimenting with a technique called enhanced rock weathering, designed to improve degraded soils and help save the planet from climate doom. Enhanced rock weathering takes advantage of Earth's natural carbon cycle, which keeps carbon dioxide in perpetual rotation between air, water, and soil. Volcanic rock naturally traps atmospheric CO2 in a process that transforms the gas into a solid form, Like a thermostat, rock weathering can slowly moderate Earth's temperatures over geologic time by keeping atmospheric levels of CO2, a greenhouse gas, in check. Over the last two decades, scientists the world over have studied how to accelerate weathering as a potential climate solution. Grinding volcanic rock into powder increases the surface area available for trapping CO2. While this rock dust can theoretically be spread anywhere, proponents typically target cropland, which offers easy access and multiple crop benefits. Enhanced rock weathering is one of many carbon dioxide removal technologies that aim to strip the atmosphere of excess carbon dioxide. Approaches that lock up carbon dioxide could be key to meeting climate goals, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, a target of the 2015 Paris Agreement, would require the removal of 100 billion to 1,000 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide by the end of the century, the IPP says. Enhanced rock weathering could put a substantial dent in that quantity, a team of researchers in the U.S. reported last year in the journal Earth's Future. If applied to all arable lands on the planet, the method could remove up to 215 billion tons over the next 75 years, according to the team's computer simulations. That's a fifth of the IPCC's maximum estimate for needed removals. Crushing rocks is almost too dumb an idea, but it actually works, says Adam Wolf, co-founder and chief innovation officer of ION, an enhanced rock weathering startup that appeared in Time magazine's list of best inventions this year. Enhanced rock weathering may sound like a no-brainer, but it faces significant obstacles, including fears of potential environmental contamination and the challenge of how to measure and verify the carbon removal. There's also concern that this relative newcomer to climate change mitigation might shunt money from longer-standing priorities, like preserving forests and their carbon-absorbing trees. Because some approaches to carbon dioxide removal have been embraced by the fossil fuel industry, critics also worry that supporting them will allow oil and gas producers to keep emitting rather than shifting to clean energy. But the reality is that the world is far from achieving its emission reduction goals and short on time. As the IPCC warns, both emission reductions and atmospheric carbon dioxide removal are needed now. The only sensible course is to stop engaging in turf wars and immediately embrace all climate solutions. Even newcomers, says Gabrielle Walker, an author and scientist by training who has founded multiple carbon dioxide removal initiatives. If we don't build climate removals to gigaton scale by 2030, Walker says, we cannot achieve our climate goals. A primer on rock weathering. Enhanced rock weathering relies on a process that's even older than the dinosaurs, the breakdown and buildup of rock. Water droplets in the atmosphere combine with carbon dioxide to form carbonic acid. When the weak acid rains down on volcanic rock, silicate minerals in the rock dissolve. This weathering releases calcium, magnesium, and other nutrients needed by plants and forms stable bicarbonate ions, molecules with a net electric charge. The bicarbonate HCO3 traps the carbon from the atmosphere. Bicarbonate flows from groundwater into streams and eventually the ocean, where corals, clams, and other critters use it to make their shells and skeletons. Upon dying, the animals sink to the ocean floor and are eventually recycled into Earth's interior at subduction zones, where one tectonic plate dives beneath another plate. The carbon remains inside the planet for tens of thousands of years or longer before volcanoes shoot out clouds of CO2 and spew silicate-containing lava, starting the cycle anew. Natural rock weathering captures about 1.1 billion tons of CO2 each year. In 1990, German-born physicist Walter Seifertz pointed out that weathering could help counter climate change. But little happened until 2006, when Dutch geochemist Olaf Schuiling suggested spreading highly reactive olivine, a mineral often found in volcanic rock, on land to pull excess CO2 from the air. Since then, research has boomed. Much of it has been spearheaded by the Leverhulme Center for Climate Change Mitigation at the University of Sheffield in England, which has conducted studies in the lab and the field on multiple continents. Spurred by promising results, dozens of enhanced rock weathering companies have formed in the last few years. Some already spread volcanic rock, like basalt. Some are in the trial phase, and some are little more than a catchy web page. Most of these companies focus on cropland. They haul basalt from mines or quarries, grind it, transport it to farms, and spread some 25 tons per hectare. Instead of basalt, the Irish company Silicate spreads leftover concrete, which is high in silicate. Companies provide the soil amendment to farmers for free, with the goal of generating revenue by selling carbon credits to large corporations such as Microsoft that want to offset their carbon footprints. The Netherlands-based company Greensand takes a different approach, using olivine gravel for pathways and edging, driveways, decorative stones, and bedding material to keep artificial turf springy. Other companies are exploring the possibility of spreading rock dust on beaches and ocean waters, which could not only draw down carbon, but potentially counter ocean acidification. The perks of rock powder. Enhanced rock weathering has multiple advantages over other forms of carbon dioxide removal, proponents say. The technique is built on a natural process, which may help lend credibility to the concept. It also builds on existing industrial processes, mining and agriculture, which can allow for rapid scale-up and reasonable expense. All carbon dioxide removal methods require energy, land, and water, and in these areas, enhanced rock weathering has a competitive edge over higher-tech methods like direct air capture and bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, an approach favored in Europe. That method involves growing crops such as sugarcane to absorb CO2 and then burning the plants, capturing the released carbon for storage underground and harnessing the heat for energy. Energy needs for rock weathering, mostly related to the grinding and transport of rock, vary widely depending on parameters like distance to a farm and the fineness of the powder. Using rock dust left over from mines can help save energy. In general, though, enhanced rock weathering typically requires only half as much energy as direct air capture. David Beerling, director of the Leverhulme Center, and colleagues reported in 2022 in the journal Communications Earth and Environment. The team studied carbon dioxide removal techniques in different countries. A direct air capture plant uses massive fans and filters to suck CO2 out of the air. By one estimate, removing 1 billion tons of CO2 in this way would require about 1,200 terawatt-hours of electricity. That's roughly three times as much electricity as the entire U.S. renewable sector generated in 2019. In addition to energy savings, enhanced rock weathering can complement existing land uses. That's unlike some other carbon dioxide removal methods, such as bioenergy, with carbon capture and storage. To achieve significant carbon removal, some researchers say this grow-and-burn strategy would need a total area of land larger than India. A study published in February in the journal Science concluded that scaling up bioenergy with carbon capture and storage may threaten food security and human rights, with potentially irreversible consequences. Another benefit of enhanced rock weathering is that it requires only a tenth or a hundredth as much water as direct air capture, bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, and some other carbon dioxide removal strategies, Birling and colleagues found. Beyond climate benefits, enhanced rock weathering could help farmers. Modern agricultural practices, tilling soil, removing dead plant matter, monocropping, and applying pesticides, herbicides, and synthetic fertilizers have damaged soil structure, eroded fields, and acidified soil. When soil becomes too acidic, essential nutrients can wash away, and microbes that help plants grow can be damaged. Overuse of nitrogen fertilizers can lead to the formation of nitrous oxide, a highly potent greenhouse gas. Farmers already add crushed limestone to fields to raise soil pH. Volcanic rock powder has the same effect, and due to differences in chemical makeup, can remove more carbon from the atmosphere than limestone can. Volcanic rock powder can also release essential plant nutrients. Add silicon, which may make plants more resistant to pathogens, and increase crop productivity. It even appears to reduce nitrous oxide emissions. Many of these benefits also come with regenerative agriculture techniques, such as no-till farming and the use of cover crops that aim to improve soil health. Enhanced rock weathering is compatible with these techniques. What could go wrong? Although the mechanics of enhanced rock weathering are well understood, the potential long-term risks are not. The most serious concern is the potential for heavy metal accumulation in soils. This concern was raised at last year's United Nations Climate Change Conference, COP28. Geochemist Gideon Henderson, Chief Scientific Advisor at the UK Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, warned against rushing to embrace enhanced rock weathering approaches that involve pure olivine. Olivine has high trace metal content, including some toxins, and in the long term may cause significant negative environmental consequences, Henderson said. Heavy metals in olivine, such as nickel, can endanger health if absorbed at high enough levels by plants and ingested by humans. Small amounts of nickel are essential for plant growth. Concerns about heavy metals arise from the fact that enhanced rock weathering works best with repeat applications, which can increase levels of the metals. The study showing a 215 billion ton reduction in atmospheric CO2 over a 75-year period assumes annual application of 10 tons of basalt per hectare. But one study, which assumed a commonly used application rate of 40 tons of basalt per hectare, suggests that safety limits for that level of application may be exceeded after only 10 years of repeat application. ION, with projects located in the southeastern U.S., uses olivine. Wolf, the company's co-founder and chief innovation officer, points out that soil nickel levels in that region are so low that nickel fertilizer is actually recommended. In addition, plants absorb nickel more readily in acidic soil, something that olivine corrects. No paper I know of has ever shown an actual toxicity impact of olivine, Wolf says, including one by Henderson. Still, at least one startup isn't taking any chances. Metalplant, an offshoot of the climate think tank, Climitigation, shows a nickel-absorbing crop on fields treated with volcanic rock powder. Then the company extracts the nickel from the plants with the aim to sell the metal. There's also the question of how adding volcanic rock powder or crushed concrete will affect soil microbes. Geochemist Frank McDermott of University College Dublin is the scientific lead at Silicate, the startup that uses concrete powder. While the microbial community generally responds well to an increase in soil pH when agricultural lime is added, basalt and concrete bring different mineral and chemical makeups. Despite extensive work, he says, scientists still don't know how the addition of these powders, perhaps in higher quantity than lime, will impact the ability of soil microbes to break down organic matter, which is essential to soil health. Soils have a big store of organic carbon, and the goal is to protect and increase it over time. But if you add material that's external to the system and the microbes that have never seen basalt or concrete before, how will they react? McDermott asks. Another unknown is the possible effect of these rock powders on the flora and fauna of adjacent lands, lakes, or ponds, or on marine life if rock powder is sprinkled into the ocean. Measure and verify. In the acronym-heavy world of carbon dioxide removal, one jumble of letters stands out above all others, MRV, which stands for Measurement, Reporting, and Verification. Accurate MRV is essential to assessing a technique's effectiveness and enabling companies to sell carbon credits. But how do you measure something you can't see? A direct air capture machine filters CO2 from the air and concentrates it in purified form, allowing for easier measurement. With enhanced rock weathering, there's no way to directly measure how much CO2 is drawn down. Companies currently use multiple methods of measurement. For instance, soil releases a certain amount of CO2 into the atmosphere through normal soil respiration. The application of rock powder lowers the percentage of CO2 released. Respiration can be measured to infer carbon removal. Bicarbonate levels in groundwater samples are another measurement, along with quantifying how much rock powder dissolves. Ion developed its own process by using a trace element within olivine that leaves a fingerprint after the rock breaks down. Each approach comes with uncertainties, but using multiple methods together might help verify that carbon removal has happened and provides a close approximation of the amount. Yet conducting these field measurements can be a burden for small startups trying to stay afloat. For that reason, many companies are turning to simulations to predict CO2 removal rates. Skeptics of this method say that simulations can't yet replicate the complexity of nature. Ecologist Benjamin Holton of Cornell University was among the first researchers to conduct field studies on enhanced rock weathering with basalt. Carbon drawdown can be accurately measured in small, tightly controlled test plots, he argues. But scaling these measurements to something as big as an acre or multiple acres or thousands of acres is still not possible. It's just not there yet. I see and think what we're seeing is a collision between the startup culture wanting things to work, wanting to believe things will work, and that's so important, versus the scientific process, which is conservative, careful, and calculated, Holton adds. The truth is somewhere in the middle. Some researchers, however, point to simulation's fundamental role in studying climate. If you accept that models, computer models, can be used to model arguably more complicated systems like climate change, I think it's not a giant leap to expect that we can get models that are good enough to determine rock weathering and carbon dioxide removal rate, says geoengineer Mike Kelland of the Leverholm Center. Perhaps one way to increase confidence in carbon removal estimates is to work with an independent rating institution. In 2022, Puro Earth, a carbon credit platform used in Finland, or Puro Earth, developed the first set of certification standards for enhanced rock weathering. Puro.Earth hopes this will encourage companies to adopt uniform measurement methods and soothe nervous carbon credit buyers. To sell enhanced rock weathering carbon credits, Puro.Earth requires that a company provide field data that show two different signals of rock weathering, such as measurements of respiration and bicarbonate levels. Startups must also prove that carbonic acid and not some other soil acid weathered the rock. Companies also have to take quantifiable measurements of CO2 capture, and the Puro Earth organization requires proof that fields don't exceed guidelines for heavy metal contamination. Puro.Earth is adamant in that only robustly quantified and verified carbon removals can be credited, says Marianne Tiganen, co-founder and head of Standard at Puro.Earth. Any enhanced weathering project must verify their soil conditions and explicitly and conservatively quantify the effect of all the various uncertainty factors and risks of reversal. Startups in North America, South America, the United Kingdom, and India are using Perot.Earth's methodology. And in April 2023, Microsoft bought the first carbon credits based on enhanced rock weathering under Perot.Earth's crediting system from the Scottish company UNDO. The future. Research on enhanced rock weathering is far from done. In a 2020 study published in the journal Nature, Beerling and colleagues pinpointed the United States, China, India, and Brazil as the major agricultural countries that are most suitable for immediate deployment of enhanced rock weathering. The strategy could help the United States and China offset up to 10% of their emission reduction goals. For India, it's 40%, and for Brazil, it's more than 100%. Combining enhanced rock weathering with other strategies could lead to even greater effect. Rock powder used alongside bioenergy with carbon capture and storage may improve the health of feedstock crops, and adding it to other nature-based methods can make agricultural land a more effective carbon sink. To date, though, most government funding for carbon removal in the U.S. and Europe has gone to high-tech solutions like direct air capture. But that balance may be ever so slightly shifting. In May, the U.S. Department of Energy awarded 5 enhanced rock weathering projects, including ION, $50,000 each to scale up the technology. And the European Union recently allowed enhanced weathering advocates to apply for consideration as an eventual removal strategy in Europe. In this all-hands-on-deck moment, collaboration and open-mindedness may be key to avoiding the worst effects of climate change, Walker says. All carbon removal solutions need support. This is not a zero-sum game, she says. This is an attempt to get to net zero at the speed that we need. And this article, Crushing Climate Change, Enhanced Rock Weathering Could Capture Carbon Dioxide and Improve Cropland, is part of the series The Climate Fix and appears in the June 29, 2024 issue of Science News. And now, a New York Times trilobite entitled The Eruption of Mount Vesuvius Wasn't Pompeii's Only Killer. While the volcano's eruption was deadly, research shows that many people in the ancient Roman city died in building collapses from the earthquake associated with the outburst. The article is written by Jordan Pearson, posted on July 18, 2024. Pompeii was destroyed by the catastrophic eruption of Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD, entombing residents under layers of volcanic ash. But there is more to this story of an ancient Roman city's doom. Research published Thursday in the middle of July in the journal Frontiers in Earth Science offers proof that Pompeii was simultaneously wrecked by a massive earthquake. The discovery establishes a new timeline for the city's demise and shows that fresh approaches to research can reveal additional secrets from well-studied archaeological sites. Researchers have always had an inkling that seismic activity contributed to the city's destruction. The ancient writer Pliny the Younger reported from his vantage point in a nearby town that the eruption of Vesuvius had been accompanied by violent tremors. But until now, no evidence had been discovered to support this historical account. A team of researchers led by Domenico Sparice from Italy's National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology decided to investigate this gap in the record. Dr. Sparice said that excavations of Pompeii to date had not included experts in the field of archaeoseismology, which deals with the effects of earthquakes on ancient buildings. Contributions from specialists in this area were key to the discovery, he said. The effects of seismicity have been speculated by past scholars, but no factual evidence has been reported before our study, Dr. Sparicha said, adding that the finding was very exciting. The team focused on the insula of the chaste, lovers. This area encompasses several buildings, including a bakery and a house, where painters were evidently interrupted by the eruption, leaving their frescoes uncolored. After excavation and careful analysis, the researchers concluded that walls in the insula had collapsed because of an earthquake. First, they ruled out hazards, such as falling debris, as a primary cause of the destruction. A deposit of stones under the wall fragments in the insula suggested it did not crumble during the eruption's initial stage. Then they compared the damage to known effects of seismic destruction, for example, on historical buildings. The excavation also revealed a pair of skeletons covered with wall fragments in the insula. One skeleton even showed signs of having attempted to take cover. According to the researchers, bone fracture patterns and crushing injuries observed in modern earthquake victims are evidence that these unfortunate Romans were killed by a building collapse. The end result in an updated timeline of Pompeii's epic demise. First, volcanic lapilli, small stones, rained down for 18 hours, causing many roofs to collapse and killing people who sought shelter. Then, an earthquake triggered by the eruption violently rocked the city, killing even more residents. Finally, massive flows of ash and debris streamed through the city streets, sealing Pompeii's fate for eternity. Kevin Dykus, an archaeologist at the University of Oregon, who has participated in excavations of Pompeii, said the new evidence is amazing and shows how interdisciplinary approaches can lead to new discoveries. The evidence is always there. It just takes new questions and new eyes to look for it, he said. Archaeology shouldn't be an entirely insular profession. Dr. Dykus pointed to how archaeologists are bringing in experts from the fields of architecture, data science, and forensic anthropology to answer questions about the lives of average people in Pompeii, and not just their deaths. The interdisciplinary approach used by Dr. Sparicha and his team could even aid the investigation of the effects of Vesuvius's eruption on cities beyond Pompeii. While Pompeii may be the most famous example of a city devastated by the volcano in 79 AD, it was hardly the only one. We can be pretty sure that besides Pompeii, other cities, such as Aplantis, Stabiae, or Herculaneum, were affected by the earthquake. Now that researchers know what to look for, they can aim to build timelines of destruction for those neighboring regions. There is also likely more to discover in Pompeii itself. The new study suggests that other building collapses throughout Pompeii may have been misattributed to volcanic activity, when in reality, an earthquake was to blame, Dr. Sparicha said. The team is now expanding its research to other areas of the city. Pompeii has been the focus of many excellent volcanological studies. But there is still information that can be gained from the eruption and its effect on the city and its inhabitants, Dr. Sparicha said. And this New York Times trilobite, "The eruption of Mount Vesuvius wasn't Pompeii's only killer," was posted in the New York Times on July 18, 2024. And finally, an excerpt from the June 29, 1974 issue of Science News. 50 years ago, sweet discovery for wine industry. Pierce's disease remains a problem for California grape growers. Pathologists have identified the cause of the disease. They were able to isolate a small, non-motile, rod-shaped bacterium, which is probably a new species and therefore as yet unnamed. 50 years later, an update. Pierce's disease still vexes California vineyards and is estimated to cost the state more than $100 million per year. But researchers now know more about the culprit, Xylella fastidiosa. The bacterium spreads among grapevines via insects, specifically sharpshooter leafhoppers and spittlebugs. When the insects suck sap from an infected plant, they pick up the microbe, which harmlessly multiplies in their mouths. Leafhoppers and spittlebugs then transmit the pathogen to vines when they latch on to a healthy plant. The subsequent infection prevents water and nutrients from flowing into the plant, eventually killing it. There's still no treatment for Pierce's disease. Perhaps one day it will be possible to genetically engineer domesticated grapevines to be resistant to the bacteria. And that 50 years ago update in the June 29, 2024 issue of Science News. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.